for those who know every line, and for those finding Star Wars for the very first time, welcome to Growing Up Skywalker.
Welcome to Growing Up Skywalker. I'm Sam.
Hi, I'm Anna.
Today, we're throwing a bit of a curveball. We're doing an emergency triple header.
Because we watched the Win Kathu job, and I looked at Sam, and I was like, do you have anything to talk about? And he was like, do you have anything to talk about?
So we wanted to put a little bit more meat on the table, so to speak. So we added visions and voices to our watch this week. So if you follow along by watching ahead of time, now's the time to pause and catch up with us. We're doing a triple header of The Win Kathu Job, The Inside Man, and Visions and Voices.
That is season 3 of Rebels, episodes 9, 10, and 11. And I feel like it's been since the Clone Wars that we did a triple header.
We were always like, it's too much work. And I think we're actually like able to do it now.
Yeah. So, okay, give us like a 1 minute summary of The Win Kathu Job.
You got it. So Ezra calls in Hondo and as Morrigan to pull a cargo heist on a battered, embittered Imperial transport, which is sinking into a storm on a gas giant.
As Morrigan, as you may remember, is the gross strawberry man from all across Rebels.
He's just the worst. They land, they connect some cool grappling hooks to this ship. The crew heads down, they start loading up proton bombs. As Morrigan runs off and gets captured by a sentry droid, he activates all the sentry droids. There's a running battle outside. Everyone escapes with their lives.
Yeah, the whole point was to get everyone loot, and they all work together to get loot. But the rebels are finally smarter than Hondo, and they're like, get our loot off first.
There's a lot of jokes in this episode, and we finally resolve with Hondo and Ez Morrigan with a huge crate. And they're like, half of this is mine. We fought so hard for it. And it opens up on the Ugnaught that Hondo had left behind, who managed to escape himself.
The only note I wrote for this episode is the devil works hard, but Hondo Onaka works harder.
For less.
So with that said, let's talk about the actual episodes that we will be recapping.
We have actually, besides that, two bangers. So let's hit the first one, The Inside Man.
These episodes slap. Okay, I'm going to cover an inside man where there are so many blasts from the past. This episode is like the Rebels' take on Narkeena 5.
Yeah, it really is, although it came out before Narkeena 5, but it is Narkeena 5.
Ezra and Kanan show up on Lothal for the first time in a while to fan the flames of Rebel activity. Ooh. There is a big chase scene through the streets. Rider Azadi shows up and throws them in the back of his speeder.
He's like, don't worry, it's a rental, as he drives it between the legs of a walker.
And they're like, we're never going to get away. And he's like, don't worry. We just have to get up to 190 clicks per hour. Watch. And then as they hit the speed governor, the Imperial Stormtrooper speeder bikes burst into flames. It turns out that Rider Azadi has planted a bunch of inside Lothalians in the Imperial factory on Lothal, and they have been sabotaging all of the equipment. So they planted this failure, mechanical failure. So Ezra and Kanan are like, neat, let's infiltrate the factory and do the same thing to this mysterious new Imperial super weapon we've been hearing about.
Because there is one, and it is in Section A2, and it's a big deal.
However, Thrawn has twigged on. As they line up for their first shift in the factory, he shows up and all of the workers are in these like Ant-Man and the Wasp orange suits with face masks.
A lot of PPE, honestly.
Yeah. And Mr. Sumar is the man that he calls out of the lineup. Mr. Sumar has been one of the inside men sabotaging the equipment, and he makes Mr. Sumar test out one of the bikes. It overheats, it explodes, it kills Mr. Sumar, and then Thrawn is like, thanks for your attention. Everything that you manufacture in this facility will be tested by you personally. So that's spicy.
Mm-hmm.
Kanan and Ezra have to make a very fast escape and salvage something from the mission. So they run into the hallway, they knock out some troopers, they steal their uniforms, and they make it over to the special A2 section of the factory, where the new weapon is being built. They have Chopper scam his way into the command center and copy over some data.
That's such a great scene. There's a lot of good scenes in here.
And then when Chopper gets the floppy disk, they try to escape and end up locked in an elevator with who else but Agent Kallus, who it turns out is Fulcrum.
He's like, hey, I know who you are, rebels. And they just start beating the crap out of him. And he's like, no, wait, I'm Fulcrum. I'm helping out.
I'm also a rebel.
Please stop hitting me.
Turns out Zeb recruited him on the Ice Moon. There is hope for Kalizeb after all.
You've never even once let that flame go down.
I am going down with this ship. It is my secondary OTP. So Kallus gets them into the communication center so they can talk to Ryder Azadi, organize an escape plan. They knock Kallus through a sheet of glass to make it look good. They make it to the east side of the factory. Ryder is attacking the gates to cover their escape, and they grab the teeniest, tiniest little walker and try to fit in with the big guys. And Thrawn is like, please attack that walker. And they like waddle under one of the big walkers, and it kneels down and crunches them. And then they slice their way up through the ceiling and infiltrate the big ones, and they're like, nice try. And they make it to the speeders, and they're home free. Except Thrawn calls in Governor Price and Agent Kallus and is like, it is clear that there is a mole in this organization, and we must find them and murder them. Wouldn't you agree, Agent Kallus? So Thrawn strikes again, basically.
Thrawn has like a 95% chance of being sure that it's Agent Kallus.
So that's an insight, man. What happens in Visions and Voices?
So Visions and Voices starts off and we're at the briefing on Atalon because they're getting ready to strike Lothal. They're ready to take out this factory. Oh, at the end of the Inside Man, they learn the data, which turns out to be a TIE Defender, which is better than an X-Wing in every capacity. And they're like, oh, that's a really scary thing. We can't let them build that. So the beginning of Visions and Voices, Hera's putting together the attack plan, and Ezra is having a full-on psychotic break, mental breakdown, because Maul is standing in there with him, talking to him, and every time he looks, he's like, there's Maul, and everyone's like, what's wrong with you? He's like, there's Maul! He passes out, he wakes back up, he's held back by Kanan and Sabine as he's about to lightsaber a dude in half, because he thinks he's Maul. So he's not doing great at all. Hera's like, I'm going on this mission. And Kanan's like, well, I'm going to take care of Ezra. So we got stuff to do. First, he asks Sabine to place a tracker in Ezra's communicator. Then he takes Ezra to the Bendu. And he's like, hey, Bendu, what's wrong with my Padawan? And Ezra's like, I did the thing with the dark side force user. We opened up the holocron. We didn't quite finish the connection. And the Bendu's like, well, that's not good.
And then the Bendu's like, what do you want? And Ezra's like, I want to stop seeing Maul everywhere. And Bendu's like, please don't turn around then.
They turn around, the Bendu disappears, and Maul is actually factually right there.
Yeah.
And he's like, my apprentice needs to come with me. Our messages are mixed. And there's really no choice you have in the matter because I have a dead man switch that is communicating to the Empire. So
here's what happened. Ezra cut off the mind connection between him and Maul when they joined the Jedi and Sith holocrons mm-hmm. together. They each got a little piece of the information that they wanted, but they also grabbed a bunch of other information from each other's heads. So Maul found out the secret location of Chopper Base Ezra got a bunch of mixed up stuff about what Maul wanted to know. Now they need to go to a secret third location and unjumble their brains.
So they go to this secret third location, which is Maul's lair on the dead planet of Dathomir.
Ugh, Dathomir. I love it so much.
So Maul lives in a cave. It's got all sorts of stuff written in blood on the walls. It's got a weird, freaky portrait of Satine.
It's the one he stole from her throne room, Sam.
He's got lots of stolen stuff.
It's like the Red Yarn conspiracy meme,
yeah,
but so much creepier.
It's made out of like blood-stained murder implements. And he's like, hello, Ezra, I have made you this juice out of Night Sister goop. We're going to trip balls. And Ezra is like, well, you need to try it first. And Maul's like, fine, whatever. But we both need to drink it.
So they stand by the old Night Sister's altar and they both drink glowing green booger juice.
Which turns their eyes green. Their eyes shine up. It makes a huge cloud of craziness and it clarifies their vision.
Yeah, they each find out the answer to their question. Darth Maul wants to know, where is he? And Ezra wants to know, how do I defeat the Sith? And it turns out the answer was C all along.
Yeah.
They were asking not the same question, but looking for the same answer.
The answer to both their questions is Obi-Wan Kenobi on Tatooine with the lightsaber.
Yes.
So they get that information. And then once they're done, Sabine and Kanan have followed them. However, now that they've drank the juice, the ghosts of Dathomir wish to charge for the juice. And they're like, you must pay us for our information.
So in flesh and blood.
So they're being swarmed by ghosts, and the ghosts possess Sabine and Kanan. So there's a crazy fight back and forth because at this point, Sabine has picked up one of the interesting toys of the Jedi, or actually of Maul, which is the darksaber. So there's a bunch of lightsaber fighting back and forth.
And darksaber.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, Ezra yeets Sabine out of the cave because there's a no ghosts beyond this line on the outside of the cave, which depossesses her. By this point, Maul has been like, join me. And Ezra's like, no. And so Maul's like, deuces, and takes off.
Yeah. Maul is like, oh, we owe a life debt to the Night Sisters. Deuces. Mm-hmm. I'm going to fly away. Good luck with your friend. And Ezra is like, my friends are now enslaved to the Night Sisters. I must do something.
So he takes care. He rescues Sabine and then he goes back in. He finds Kanan on top of this altar and the ghosts are like, we're going to use his body to create the Night Sisters again.
Like, ew.
And Ezra's like, I'm the one you want. Take me. And they're like, fine, whatever. And they leave Kanan and they're about to enter him. Ezra picks up the darksaber. He picks up his lightsaber and he smashes the altar. And the ghosts are like, oh no.
She's like, I'm going to have to owe you one.
And then they get free and head off. And so they don't know where Obi-Wan Kenobi is, but they know that Obi-Wan Kenobi is the right person to answer Ezra's question, which is, how do we destroy the Sith?
Yeah, here's how it shakes out. Maul knows everything. He is probably headed to Tatooine to find and kill Kenobi. Mm-hmm. The Spectres know that the answer is Kenobi, do not know where he is. On the way out, mm-hmm. Sabine grabs the darksaber.
She's like, huh, that seems interesting and important and valuable.
So Sabine is theoretically now the leader of Mandalore.
Yes, although that bit hasn't quite been made clear to us on what the current way the Darksaber manifests as the leader of the Mandalorians yet.
Okay. I feel like I picked that up from season 2 of The Clone Wars, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, so in season 2 of The Clone Wars, it was the Duchess Satine had put in the new pacifist regime. And so the Darksaber was being wielded by Pre Vizsla. And he was like, Death Watch is the real Mandalorians.
And then they break the back of Satine's pacifist rule.
Uh-huh. And then Pre Vizsla takes over and he uses the darksaber and eventually gets his butt whooped by Obi-Wan a bunch of times. And then at some point in the comic books and in season 7, Maul maintains the lightsaber. And then over the last, you know, 13, 14 years, he's just shoved it into his weird spider cave on Dathomir.
Yeah, I guess, and then we can get into bigger themes. But I guess what I remember from season 5, 6, or 7 of the Clone Wars is that Maul defeats Pre Vizsla, takes the Darksaber.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the passing of the Darksaber into Maul's hands gives him authority over all Mandalorians.
According to that particular Mandalorian belief, yes.
Okay, got it.
So.
So.
First, the Wincathu job, it was funny. Second, moving right along.
Yeah, I mean, the Wincathu job. So we watched Wincathu job and Inside Man last night. And we were like, wow, Inside Man, what an episode. What did you think about that first one? And I'm like, did anyone grow? Did it advance the plot at all?
There was a little bit of, so Zeb was in charge of the mission and Ezra's like, whatever, Captain Aurelius. And he's being a real jerk about it. And then he like, lets go by the end.
Yeah. I mean, Zeb does a great job running the mission.
He does.
He is laser focused on the goal. They successfully get 16 proton bombs for the rebellion out of this extremely hair-raising adventure.
Hey, free proton bombs.
And Hondo Ohnaka graduates from lying to them 100% of the time to 75% of the time. And he's like, you should be grateful. This, my friends, is character growth. And that is what I got out of the Wincathu job.
Yeah, there's a bunch of funny one-liners, but this is kind of a filler episode. So, Inside Man.
Well, before we talk about these episodes as discrete pieces.
Big picture stuff.
For me as a new viewer, it felt like there were so many different threads weaving in and out of these episodes. So for my clarity, I want to know first, what themes or stories or threads, if any, are tying all of these episodes together?
So all three of them have a connection to the larger universe. The Wincathu job has the sentry droids, and they're these big, like, 8-foot-tall stormtrooper-looking droids. Those are a canon import from the Dark Forces video game, which is quite fun, quite dated, although a remake just came out. And then in The Inside Man, there's the TIE Defender, and that's a canon immigrant from the X-Wing game. And then finally, in Visions and Voices, we are connecting all of Maul's threads, because he's got a lot of emotional, spiritual, and plot baggage that he carries with him. And now that we've connected it to the Dathomirians and the Night Sisters, we've connected all of it together. So I think what these three episodes do is they anchor us in time and place to say, this is probably something that will be recognized as a watershed moment of like, now we see that Fulcrum is a title and we are rapidly recruiting things. And no matter how powerful Thrawn is, there are still people willing to stand up to him. People who know how powerful he is. No matter how powerful Maul is, there are people willing to stand up to him. And he's, in fact, weakened. He's on the very much waning years of his plan. And Hondo exists.
Interesting. I guess I do kind of like the idea that every quasi-antagonist figure in these episodes is shown to be fallible.
Yeah, there's that.
Yeah, like, Asmorgan is dumb. We knew that. Hondo can be easily distracted from his goals and can be forced to help the rebellion if you trick him.
Yeah.
And Thrawn has people under his very nose who are undermining his work. And Maul is so deeply traumatized that his mission in life has become small.
Yeah, it's only revenge now.
It's only revenge, it's only Kenobi. He had the power to change the galaxy when he was in charge of the Mandalorians and when he was in charge of his crime syndicate. And he has given all of that up, and now he is playing on a smaller field again.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would love to know, like, did Kira depose him at some point?
Or,
like,
what happened? I hope so. Yeah. She totally could.
So he's become, or did he just retire? He's like, hey, I've done all I can with all this, and I'm just ready to move on to the next phase of my life, the final phase of my life, which is killing Obi-Wan Kenobi. Now, there is an interesting element at the end of that episode. As Maul is leaving, he's like, come with me, we will meet with Kenobi. Both of our visions are there. You can join me as a friend, as a brother.
Mm.
And that is very much Maul looking back to the relationship he had with Savage, because that is when he was in the ascendancy of his power. When it was him and Savage, they were ready to face Palpatine. They lost, but they tried.
Yeah. Gosh, I lost a lot of respect for Maul this episode.
Mm.
He is living this sad, lonely life in these filthy, desolate places and ruining everyone's day every time he comes across them. And he would have left his debts to the Night Sisters unpaid or sacrificed Kanan or Sabine. He would keep Ezra by his side to be this quasi stand-in Savage, even though Ezra is nothing like Savage.
He probably would have given him some Night Sister go juice.
Yeah.
Mega Ezra.
It's just like he's so traumatized. And like the irony of Maul saying to Ezra, "You must forget your past.
I know.
You must forget your attachments. Leave your memories behind." And I'm like, Maul, do you hear yourself, sir? Yeah, he could be so great.
He has been so great. And it's really, I think, a treatise on power of like, you have it as long as you hold on to it. And especially if your requirements for holding on to it are physical, like they are for the Sith, you kind of have to slow down at a certain point. Like, Maul is still one of the scariest lightsaber duelists we've seen on screen in Rebels. But I think if it came down to him in a fight versus Kanan and Ezra, he would actually be hard-pressed. I think he's very much in his waning years. He's an old, broken man.
This actually reminds me, and these are non-canon, but one of our favorite Vision Season 1 episode is called The Elder.
Yes.
And it is about a Padawan and a Master who come across an Elder Sith Force user. And there's this beautiful theme where the Master is like, I have passed the midpoint of my power. Every day I will grow weaker. You, my Padawan, are still waxing. Like, every day you will go stronger in your power until you hit the midpoint of your life. And the only reason that I was able to defeat this dark side Force user is because he has so far distanced himself from the peak of his power that, like, he's on the far edge of his arc.
Yeah.
And I think that's so true with Ezra, Kanan, and Maul. Ezra is growing. Kanan is at his peak. And Maul is really on the downswing.
Yeah.
They're like the phases of the moon.
If you want to learn more about that episode, check out our Patreon. We go into a lot of depth in all of Visions. We're almost done with season two. But yeah, I agree that I think Maul has reached, Maul's semi-retired. And he's really using people. I think that he's kind of a cracked egg because his emotional turmoil is up and down. He doesn't seem to be able to hang onto the plot as well anymore. And that, ironically, same thing is true of Hondo and the M'Kathu job. Like Hondo. Hondo screws around enough and messes about enough and, you know, obfuscates the truth and just lies enough that he walks out of there after an hour or whatever with one crate full of his Ugnaught. And that's it. And he's like, you know, it's fine. But he, you know, you can tell he's kind of disappointed that he kind of wanted a basket full of treasure. That would have been nice.
Well, yeah. So Hondo was standing by the little zip line that carried the crates into the ghost the whole time, could have been loading it up full of his own treasure.
Yeah.
And simply did not because he was distracted by greed.
Filling his pockets. Yeah. Distracted by greed. And that's...
It's a parable, Sam.
It is. But it's also like Hondo has got such bad habits of lying, dissembling, scheming, and cheating everyone all the time that he is fundamentally broken as well.
Oh, are you saying that Hondo and Maul are mirrors of each other?
Well, they have met, right? Because Maul and Savage deleted Hondo's base and killed all of his pirates.
Oh, yeah.
That's when Adi Gallia died. She got gored by Savage.
Yeah, literally horrifying.
But, and That was when Hondo was at the peak of his power as well.
I know. He was a pirate lord, like, sprawled across his mountains of gold.
And then Maul killed all of his pirates. And what does he do? He's also living in the past, just trying to be like, I just need to build back my wealth. It doesn't really matter that my wealth was destroyed by General Grievous or Maul or Vader or whomever. I just need to build it back. Just one more big score and I'll be good.
Oh, interesting.
And Maul is like, it doesn't matter that I had all this wealth. I just need to finish the job. I need to finish the one thing that I set out to do in Phantom Menace. Just kill Obi-Wan Kenobi.
My 30-year mission.
For real. Yeah.
Wow, I hadn't even thought about that. Maul and Hondo, of all people, are both deposed kings.
Yeah, and they're both, you know, let's call it friends with Obi-Wan Kenobi, so.
You know what? This actually reminds me of a very faint but interesting parallel that I noticed between Maul and Hondo also, which is that they both are trying to ingratiate themselves to Ezra so that he can be their apprentice.
Yeah, yeah.
Despite the fact that they don't know Ezra very well.
I think that is definitely the elements that bookend this, is that Ezra is wise to everyone trying to mess with him.
Yeah, because, street smart.
Yeah, because you can't con a con man, you know, and he used to run cons, and he's also like been to the dark side, been to the light side. He knows all these things. And he's like, I saw the appeal of the dark side and I saw what happened. I saw that I had to deal with the consequences of that. So I'm no longer doing that. I'm not leaving my friends behind because, as he told Mart in Iron Squadron, it's all about friends. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not about ships. It's not about warheads. It's about friends. If you have friends, you're alive. And so Ezra's learned that lesson, and that is distinctly the lesson that Hondo and Maul haven't learned.
Yeah, despite the lesson being foisted upon them, mm-hmm. like, Hondo's only reward for this job is to get back his Ugnaught melt that he left behind in the first place.
Yeah, and only I guess, 49% of them, because there's some funny math. As Morgan gets half of them, and Hondo agrees to give Melch 2%. So Melch now owns 2% of himself.
Oh, no.
Which is probably more than he started with.
According to As Morgan, Hera owns 0% of herself because he technically bought her as a slave.
Yeah, for a good price.
Which we touch on so briefly in this episode, mm-hmm. and it is in poor taste.
Hera's pretty fed up with most of Ezra's shenanigans. They keep having to be like, Ezra, you keep getting us in these absolute crazy hairball schemes. And he's like, they always do work out. And they're like, this is sus. You need to, like, grow up. We're no longer a kid's show where we can have madcap adventures. We're going to blow up this factory. And he's like, I don't want to blow up a factory.
Yeah, but like, Hondo gets Melch back as a way of the universe saying, you must have friends. Mm-hmm. And Maul has been lost since he lost Savage.
Yeah.
That was the last time he had real clarity and purpose and focus. And that's the last time he was close to his goal of defeating Palpatine.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, so.
Well, I think it's really important that we talk about the inside man, because that is also meat and potatoes. We've been glossing right over it.
Okay, last thing that I want to say about Visions and Voices, and then we can move on, is that I felt really impressed with Ezra in that episode. Mm-hmm. Because he felt like such a grown-up. There's that line where he's talking to the Night Sister spirits. And they're like, we must have our blood and flesh debt repaid. Mm-hmm. And he's like, if Maul made you that promise, it is my promise as well. Let me pay the debt.
Mm-hmm.
And that is such a grown-up man thing to do. Mm-hmm. I'm like, Ezra is a man.
He's also scamming them.
He then bamboozles them out of paying the debt, which is delightful, which is very Ezra.
It is.
But anyway, okay. An inside man.
This is the filling to this sandwich of two old men, because everyone in Inside Man is pretty competent.
Yes.
Even the old men, like Mr. Sumar and Ryder Azadi.
Yeah.
I need to know, for my edification, did you know that Fulcrum was Kallus?
Hondo P, no.
Okay.
Absolutely not. I thought he was getting recruited by the force of his powerful love for his powerful love interest, Zeb.
Uh-huh.
But I had no idea he was Fulcrum. I think that's delightful.
Even after he lets Sabine and the Antilles boys go?
Sam, he did it for love.
Okay.
If he is Fulcrum, it's because of love, the power of love. No, I had no idea. But I also never guessed that Ahsoka was Fulcrum number one.
Oh, okay.
So you
can hear the voice, and I genuinely almost dropped. I did it. I was listening to last week's episode, and I did a very awkward segue because I'd forgotten that we hadn't revealed that Kallus was Fulcrum.
Oh, yet. No.
I was like, speaking of Fulcrum, how about that Kallus character? And I just like inserted 8 words in between in a panic stop.
Don't worry, Sam. I picked up on none of it. I am oblivious. If it is not spelled out in the subtitles, I will not figure it out.
We were watching the Rebels recon and they're interviewing Pablo Hidalgo. And he's like, the funny thing about this is the fan base will guess and they'll guess the right answer and the wrong answer. And there will always be ambiguity. So you really do have to be blunt about what you tell them. You have to be like, someone has to be like, I'm Fulcrum. And they're like, oh, that is Fulcrum. Yeah. I thought this the whole time.
Star Wars fans will guess the right answer and then argue about it forever and convince themselves that they're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I love that about them.
So Fulcrum, Kallus, is in a real pickle. And so is the whole rebellion. Because this is the big rebellion picture stuff. This new TIE fighter is coming out. It is horrifying. Sabine is scared of it. Hera is scared of it. And Thrawn is like, hello, mole Kallus.
Oh, no.
What do you think of the big picture of what's going on? Like, what are the vibes from a new viewer's end?
Yeah. So the vibes are horrifying, of course. I will say the vibes are not irredeemable to me. So the title, An Inside Man, makes it singular. It's not the inside men. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that there are many, many, many inside men in this episode. I thought Sumar was the inside man because he's sabotaging all of the Imperial equipment. And then I thought, oh, maybe it's Ryder Azadi because Ryder Azadi is orchestrating all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out it was also Kallus.
Yeah.
So it makes the Empire feel like it has holes everywhere and it is vulnerable everywhere because there are too many moles even for Thrawn to pick them out of a lineup. Like, he picks out Sumar, doesn't pick out Ryder, maybe picks out Kallus, and then the next one, and the next one, and the next one will just pop up like whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
Literally whack-a-mole, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So he's tied because he doesn't have enough resources to deal with this. And it's an interesting dichotomy because there's 4 Imperials running around doing stuff. It's Lieutenant Leist, who was embarrassed by Princess Leia. He's there.
Oh, yeah, that guy.
That guy. It's Kallus, Price, and Thrawn.
Uh-huh.
And whenever Thrawn is like, yo, old man, get on this bike until it explodes and you die, Price is like gleefully clapping. And Kallus and Leist are like, this is like brutal, man. Like, are we seriously doing this?
Yeah, so there's the thing. Because of the Empire's cruelty, every time they whack a mole, 10 more will pop up because of how cruel they were to the mole.
And
everyone who saw Sumar exploded to death is like, wow, maybe I can't sabotage Imperial equipment anymore. I will have to find another way to completely F them in any way I can.
Or I have to change the testing parameters, pull a Volkswagen and make it so it like works in testing and not once in the field.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
You back people into a corner and they will do whatever they can. You kill everyone around them and they will be like, okay, I will simply find another way to do this.
And that vibes with what's going on with, as you said, Narkeena 5. Mm-hmm. Because although in Narkeena 5, they're sitting there and they're like, 12-hour shifts, no shoes, same clothes, group showers. The difference between that and being a mandatory factory worker on Lothal is kind of just how often you get to see the sky.
Mm.
You don't have freedom when you have a mandatory job.
Yeah, I can't believe we never thought about the Narkeena 5 prisoners sabotaging equipment. It seems like it was less possible there because of the supervision.
Yeah. Probably. I mean, also, it was, like, pretty straightforward, and it felt like they were exhausted all the time. And I think that's – and they were doing very simple work. The work on Lothal seems like it's higher order because they're actually, like, assembling things. Like, and their Kena 5, they're – we saw what they're putting together at the end, but they would be putting together, like, here's the space carburetor for the space speeder bike. And then on Lothal, they're like, add the carburetor, add the fins, add these things. So they're doing the final assembly of lots of stuff.
I guess on Lothal, it feels like one person is in charge of one bike from soup to nuts. So I kind of wonder if the Empire, I mean, so Rebels came out first, Andor came out second in real time. So it is possible that the writers were like, oh, we made too many holes in this factory. But in our chronological watch through, it feels like the Empire is siloed, where whoever runs the Narkeena 5 prison complex is like, we got to make this sabotage proof. And over on Lothal, they're like, hey, you, Sumar, worker number 5785, make a speeder bike.
Yeah, something like that, that they will have a really hard time with the quality because they're a horrific fascist empire and they don't pay people and they don't do all sorts of things. One of the interesting only parts that actually separates the formal fascist movements of our planet versus the space planets and this galactic empire in Star Wars is actually the use of privatized corporations in fascism. And we don't really see that in Star Wars. It seems like it's straight up, you work for the Empire and the Empire has its whole, like, the Empire has factories that it uses to make Imperial equipment. I find that interesting.
Yeah. So because I'm thinking about Thrawn and his art collection.
Oh, yeah. I glossed over that.
I actually have been thinking about the murals that we have seen all over Lothal. Do you remember? I can't remember which season it was in, but there was that beautiful mural in, like, the plaza of Lothal. And it showed all of the different ways that the people of Lothal City used to make their living.
Yes.
Farming and manufacturing and fishing and whatever else they were doing. Maybe mining. And now, because the Empire is taking over everyone's farms and taking over all of the mining territory, and they control presumably the rivers and the cornfields and everything, it seems like the only way to make a living is now to work in this Imperial factory that used to be a Lothal factory.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 100% fascism. The Empire has taken over every private sector and entity on Lothal.
And they've co-opted them one way or the other.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And they've reduced the, like, they won't allow the populace to even, like, live out in the boonies and farm their own food and stuff. They're like, nope, we need your arms. We're burning down your farm. We're importing food from some factory food planet. And then you have to work in the factory making stupid ATDPs or AT-ATs or TIE fighters.
Yeah. So, I mean, functionally, there is very little difference between being a prisoner on Narkeena 5 and being a Lothal citizen. So the Empire is simply turning regular life into jail.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, Marva it up. Like, people will spontaneously rise into revolution as was wisely prophesized by our favorite rebel philosopher, Nemec, because this is not the natural state of things.
And that's, like, what happens. Ryder Azadi rolls up at the end of this episode, and Mrs. Sumar is holding the rocket launcher.
And, oh, yeah.
And then they're like, Sumar didn't make it. And she's like, well, now I have nothing left to lose, you know?
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Now I'm riding in the passenger seat with a rocket launcher in this thing forever until death or victory, you know?
Yeah. So there are times when Thrawn and the Empire feel unstoppable. But interestingly, for me as a new fan, when I watched The Inside Man, instead of showcasing the Empire's strength, I think it showed off its fallibility.
Interesting. Because, like, Thrawn, so as you alluded to, he has a room full of murals, and it's like the best of Sabine Wren, the Syndulla collection taken from their blown up house. And it's got a bunch of, like, cool cave paintings from Lothal of, like, wolves and stuff. And he's staring at it, and he's pointing at it, and he's like, do you know what this is? And they're like, I don't know. And Callus is like, that is the Phoenix Starbird, and it is a representative of Sabine Wren, who is a member of the Phoenix Alliance all over Lothal. So already Thrawn recognizes that although Sato is from Mycapo, the Phoenix Cell is spiritually based in Lothal. Mm. And so by placing his base here, he's like, now this needs to be like my seat of power so I can respond more rapidly.
Yeah, but the Phoenix symbol, as he points out, or as Callus points out, is the bird that rises from the ashes, like the unconquerable spirit of the rebellion. Mm-hmm. So I know that Thrawn understands that, but it feels like, and we see this story again and again, the tighter the Empire squeezes their fist, the more people squirt out from between their fingers. Mm-hmm. So I just don't know how much it matters. Hmm.
Well, it's interesting that that's what you get out of this episode. I'm deathly afraid of TIE Defenders, so.
Yeah, I don't know what, I mean, so okay, so what we find out they're manufacturing in special section A2 of the Lothal facility is TIE fighters with shields, which I don't know why they didn't have shields to begin with.
Yeah, so part of that is that's actually also a canon immigrant thing that, like, when you watch the original trilogy, the only thing that have shields is like the Millennium Falcon size ship or smaller. Like, there's deflector screens on Y-wings and X-wings, but there's like, but you never get to hear a TIE fighter say anything. So you don't know if they have shields, but it is taken as fact from the, as a canon immigrant from the video games, that generally your B-wings, X-wings, Y-wings, A-wings are beefy. They're shielded. They got a lot of hit points. They got a lot of shielding. And the TIE fighters are made out of wet tissue paper. And in the Rogue Squadron and Wraith Squadron books, that is also visualized, that like a stray shot can take out a TIE fighter. They're a little bit armored, and they, like, you know, if you just wing them, they'll still be fine, but they don't have any shielding. A TIE fighter with shielding, and specifically one with a hyperdrive, makes it more than a match for anything, because that is what actually gives the Rebellion a lot of tactical maneuverability, is that all of their fighters have hyperdrives. So you can show up with a wing of fighters and shoot something up and then leave in the middle of nowhere.
Oh, and TIE fighters have to attach to a larger Imperial ship that has a hyperdrive.
Exactly. And so that's why, like, a Gazanti will fly around with four TIE fighters attached to it. And Artaquins probably has 16 or so. And then a Star Destroyer has, like, 144 or something. Mm-hmm. So that makes that more expensive for the Empire. And if Thrawn is like, what is the strength of the Rebellion? It's that one X-Wing is worth a dozen TIE fighters and can be in a place where it takes an hour for TIE fighters to get there. Then if I had a TIE Defender that is a one-to-one match and I can send 12 of them there to meet 12 X-Wings in 5 minutes, that is a much better tactical response than sending a Star Destroyer there in an hour.
But haven't we only seen A-Wings and B-Wings?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, so Y-wings. Why are we talking about X-Wings?
I don't know. No reason. We've seen X-Wings. We saw X-Wings in Andor. Saw Gerrera has them.
Okay. Well, Saw Gerrera is not here on Lothal.
So correct.
Fat
correct.
Load of good that does
I'm
us.
Just, I'm just informing you as to the greater stuff that we'd see on the war console on Atalon.
I feel like perhaps it sounds like X-Wings may become more important in the future if I were a betting woman.
That's a pretty easy bet. Yeah. Okay, so you aren't afraid of Thrawn more than normal.
Don't put words in my mouth. Of course, I find Thrawn to be a grave threat against everything I know and love, including Kalizev, so he better not freaking get in the way of my ship. But, like,
You're optimistic, cautiously optimistic at the end of Inside Man.
I'm not optimistic. I am feeling like Thrawn's manifold superior qualities are counterbalanced by the force to which he's applied them. Mm. I feel like Thrawn, without being tied to the Empire, would be much more effective. Mm-hmm. Because the Empire is so flawed, even if Thrawn is flawless in his horrifyingness, the Empire is not. So because he's hitched his star to the Imperial wagon, I feel like he's more vulnerable than if he was, like, enacting his own wild and terrible goals.
Interesting.
How about that?
Yeah, no, that makes sense.
Okay.
Now, okay, so that's good context for the inside man. What do you think of the knowledge, the prophecy, the destiny that Obi-Wan Kenobi is on Tatooine and is the one who will overthrow the Sith, who will destroy the Sith?
Yeah, okay, let's get back to the good stuff. I know you wanted to talk about an inside man. I was all about Visions and Voices.
I wanted to make sure we covered it. I thought it was an impactful episode.
But it was, and then we watched Visions and Voices. I find that very interesting because the seat of Sith power partially belongs to the Sith formerly known as Anakin Skywalker.
Mm-hmm.
And Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker / Darth Vader have unfinished business. So it makes sense because it feels like there needs to be some kind of conclusion to their story.
And you think Ezra and Maul have anything to do with that?
I don't know. It feels like neither of them are operating on the same playing field as Kenobi, Vader, and Palpatine.
Yeah.
So what's scary about that is that I know for a fact, because we watched Obi-Wan Kenobi, that Kenobi can defeat Vader.
Yes.
But I don't know that Kenobi could defeat Palpatine. Sidious.
Yeah.
That's what's scary. I'm much more afraid about that than anything involving Thrawn.
Interesting. Yeah, we're definitely in sort of a parallel track here of the story that is going on now in Rebels is so different from the story that is going to become the original trilogy because it's on the other side of the galaxy. It's got different characters. It's got different things going on. That this picture of Rebels being sort of a sideshow, I think, is valid.
Mm.
Like, Vader showed up and he's like, who are you guys? I don't care. Die or don't. And put Thrawn to take care of these rebels. Because Vader is still smarting over his loss to Kenobi during the Kenobi show. So I don't know. Like, I don't think that Ezra and Kanan are, as we said, like at that power level of being able to actually solve Sith problems.
What do you think the larger importance of everyone heading to Tatooine is? Or of bringing Kenobi back into the story?
I think it is interesting that Maul is like, of course it'll end where it began, because that is how he feels. He's like, ah, yes, like that is where my Sith mission to do stuff started and pretty rapidly ended. I went from Tatooine to Naboo to, you know, the garbage planet for 20 years. And so the significance of Tatooine is interesting. And it makes you wonder, we've seen that there exists spots on planets where the Force is strong, like the Temple on Lothal. And we've seen that there are entire planets where the Force is strong, like Dathomir. And then I feel like there's another layer above that of places where important things happen. And Tatooine is one of those for one reason or another. And granted, much of that is simply because Tatooine is where the first third of A New Hope occurs. And it's like a big deal because it's filmable. Because you can just go to Morocco and be like, haha, Tatooine.
Wadi Rum.
Exactly. So making it seem, you know, having that be sort of the default setting for an interesting thing happening in Star Wars is like, it's a little bit of a trope about Star Wars. Looking back on it, people are like, oh, you know, you could have any cool space planet and you just have a boring desert. And I think that does disservice to perhaps some of the more interesting things about Tatooine, which is, I mean, first of all, it's deeply inspired by Dune, which like was an absolute power, still continues to be an absolute, I mean, obviously, powerhouse in the science fiction community and is deeply influential on everything. And it's a reference to life, because people are always surprised that people like live in the desert and exist in the desert.
Ooh.
But life finds a way, you know?
Well, yeah, I think the fact that people thrive and survive on Tatooine, and that at least one of our protagonists came from there, is a testament to how strong and scrappy you have to be to mm-hmm. survive in a place like Tatooine. And if you are formed in that kind of environment, if that's your crucible, think about your character. Like, think about what you're capable of.
Mm-hmm.
All you have known is how to survive in a place where you should not,
mm-hmm.
which is very, very meaningful and poignant for all of our major characters, for Ezra, for Kanan, for Maul,
yeah.
for baby Anakin and now Darth Vader, and especially for Kenobi.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that feels very meaningful that they're headed back to Tatooine.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll get there soon enough. We got a factory to blow up first, but...
I know, and I have like two final questions.
Oh, well, hit me.
Okay. I feel concerned about some of the women in this story. So, Night Sisters.
Gone.
Ezra broke their altar, which was the seat of their power.
Mm-hmm.
Can they not come back now?
Good question. So, in the canon video games, the Jedi Fallen Order and Jedi Survivor, there exists some power on Dathomir with Meryn, the Night Sister, who is like the last Night Sister. But there's Night Sisters who aren't on Dathomir. And they have the capacity to regenerate their power using one way or the other.
Like Asajj? Did we decide that Asajj could be alive?
We didn't decide, but we might get some resolution on that soon. Importantly, getting back to the Night Sisters, more shall be revealed in other series.
Ooh, hell yeah. Mm-hmm. Sorry, heck yeah.
Heck yup.
Heck yup. Okay, good. Exciting. Yeah. Freaking love the Night Sisters.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know like what this altar that would have possessed and infested people would have done, but apparently
it sounded to me like they were going to use Kanan in a weird breeding program.
Yeah, maybe a bunch of half ghost babies.
Yeah.
Something weird. I mean, they're the Night Sisters, they do weird stuff, but I think that more shall be revealed.
More shall be revealed is a perfect answer. Okay, second question. Sabine and the Darksaber.
So is Sabine technically at this moment the formal wielder of the lightsaber?
Only if she is recognized as such. Mm. Only if there is enough credibility inherent in the Darksaber that it forces people to kneel down before her.
Okay.
Which I don't know that there is, because we just last week spent a bunch of time talking about Mandalorian internal politics and how splintered the clans are.
And how currently the clan which Sabine is part of is enthralled to the Empire.
Yeah.
So if she, despite being a outcast from her clan...
And a 16-year-old.
She's part of a clan. We hate that clan. We can't let that clan be in charge of Mandalore. She's an outcast from her clan. She's an outcast from a clan. She's a small girl. She paints her armor crazy. Like, there's a lot of reasons why she is perhaps not the correct person to be wielding the Darksaber. But if the Darksaber is the whole seat of power of Mandalore, they who wields it is wielding it and is the power behind Mandalore. So she's wielding it.
Well, but I thought when Maul defeated Pre Vizsla, there was a whole thing about how you have to defeat the owner.
Yep.
So if Sabine just grabbed it off the ground, I don't know that she defeated the previous holder, which was Maul.
What? After we finish this project, I think we should do a postscript spice run of who killed whom in what capacity in order to be wielding the Darksaber. Because, like, there's... At the end of all this, slight spoilers, there's a good case to be made for Lando being the wielder. Yeah. It goes real hairball every which way of like who is technically the correct wielder of the Darksaber, which is very funny.
Oh, delightful. Yeah, so If Sabine is seen as a traitor by the current Mandalorian party in power, which is House Vizsla, then I just feel like there's going to be some fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Sabine doesn't know how to fight with a sword, does she?
She's a Mandalorian.
She's a Mandalorian. She's a weapons expert. Okay. Yeah.
She's like, I need to learn how to fight with a sword. Is it anything like fighting with a different sword that I do know how to fight with?
Yeah, true.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
And also for that one, more shall be revealed, obviously.
Yeah. So we're headed to either Tatooine or Mandalore.
Or to Lothal.
Back to Lothal.
Although our next episode is called Ghosts of Geonosis. So apparently we have some errands to run along the way.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're taking the scenic route. I'm assuming we're going to get somewhere eventually.
Yeah, somewhere eventually.
In the meantime, would you like to take a little pit stop at our favorite scenic byway?
The Bayway.
The Bayway!
Yo, let's do it. It's time for Baywatch.
It's time for Baywatch. Sam.
Hmm.
Hoomst.
Hoomstative.
Hoomstative of you that have chosen.
I'm choosing Ezra Bridger.
Yay!
So, triple header. It's only worth a slightly less for getting the Baywatch on a triple header.
That's not true at all. You have to really stand out in a triple header. It should be worth more.
Okay, so in the Winkathu job, Hera's like, Zeb's in charge of this mission because I'm worried that Ezra will become enthralled with Hondo. And Ezra's like, I am the only one who can correctly babysit Hondo and make sure he never gets what he needs. I'll bet Ezra shoved Melch inside that crate when Hondo wasn't looking. Ezra's got all the skills that Hondo has before he was 6 years old. Ezra's great. Moving on to an inside man, there's a hilarious scene. There are many hilarious scenes in this one, but one of my favorite is after Callus brings them to the communication center and they get their message out, Ezra's like, cool, and he force shoves Callus through a wall.
I know, amazing.
Like, to be like, now it looks like we beat you up. And Kanan's like, Ezra! What? He said to make it look good. I know, but I wanted to do that. Like, Ezra's got that. It's great. And then finally, I mean, he is the star of Visions and Voices. He moves. He's like, because it's the same problem. Hera's like, hey, what do we do with Ezra if he's going to be enthralled to Maul? And Kanan's like,
enmauled.
And Kanan's like, don't worry about that. I trust Ezra. Ezra doesn't trust Maul anymore.
Right.
And Ezra does trust the Bendu enough to be like, help, please, adult creature thing. I need your help. Like, I am messed up right now. And then Ezra is willing to go with Maul, and then he does all the work to save his friends. So he's really a big damn hero through In Visions and Voices. He's hilarious in The Inside Man, and he is a jerk who half-heartedly apologizes, but he does get the job done in the Winkathu job. So that's a winner for me.
Yeah. At the very least, Ezra being a jerk to Zeb in the Winkathu job does not have the same flavor that it did when he was enthralled by the Sith holocron.
Yep.
That edge of darkness appears to have mostly, if not entirely, disappeared.
Yeah.
So it's no longer as threatening when Ezra is being a jerk, because it's not like he's vying for Zeb's position. He's just being annoying and still effective.
Yeah. Yeah, and he does listen to Zeb, and Zeb does a really good job in the Winkathu job of, like, Ezra's like, is that a good idea? And Zeb's like, don't care, but it's a good order, do it.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really a good side note for Zeb, and in season one, we had a bunch of Zeb versus Ezra, action going on, and we haven't had that in a while, and it seems like Zeb is now having to recognize that Ezra is approaching that point where he is a fully grown and respected member of the team.
I love that.
Yeah. Anyway, that's my pick. Who do you got?
Agent Callus, my friend.
Oh.
The fulcrum himself. himself.
Mm-hmm. Fulcrum 2.
Fulcrum 2. Yeah. There is an extraordinary amount of bravery and sacrifice involved in being so close to Imperial leadership and still being a mole. Mm-hmm. And I was reminded when we found out that Agent Callus is the mole of that poor schmuck in Andor.
Mm.
Who's the sweaty, pale redhead that works with Deja Miro. Oh. And Luthen has to belittle him in an elevator shaft to make him keep being a mole.
That freaking speech.
The one where I'm burning an entire galaxy for a sunrise that I'll never see. That one.
No? He's like, we need heroes. You're my hero. Deuces. Like, you don't get out of this.
Like, that speech was a watershed moment for that pale, sweaty guy. And that's what he needed to stay committed to the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And no one is around to do that for Callus, and he is staying committed anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes that sweaty man feel like a real foil to Callus, who is doing this calm and collected, efficiently, in secret, up against a much scarier leader than Partagaz, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, so Partagaz is a major, which means that he is several ranks below Admiral Thrawn.
Yeah, spicy.
But ISB Agent Callus, he's on the level of Deidre Miro.
Yeah.
You know, and so he just does, he has to strap on like a helmet and body armor and his bow rifle every day to be like, I'm going to go hunt rebels, you know, personally,
yeah.
Instead of putting together a threat. So he's the field officer compared to Deidre Miro. And that does make it all the more interesting that Callus has the strength of character to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And he's so lonely in that capacity. And I wonder if that is why at the end of this episode, it's so funny. I may have accidentally recruited him. I didn't kill him. So I guess we're friends now. Zeb being nice. Not nice, but like, I'm going to keep you alive. Like, win or lose, we're both going to get out of this alive is something that Callus found so foreign.
Well, here's the thing. We saw the moment that Callus switched sides. It was because the Empire canonically gave up on rescuing him because they exceeded the amount of hours that they spend trying to find a lost officer.
Mm-hmm.
And Callus saw that the rebels would do anything to save one friend.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so it was the power of love.
Mm-hmm.
And Callus embraces that. And anyone who can be radicalized by love is good in my books. So there.
So there.
So there.
Thanks, Anakin, for being radicalized by love.
Well, shoot. Disregard. No, don't. It's fine. You know what? He could still be redeemed, Sam.
Maybe.
He's got to probably finish stuff up with Kenobi, who he loves. So, haha. Yeah.
Haha, jokes on me.
Haha, jokes on everybody. It's love.
Well, we've got a lot of stuff to resolve. Next week, we're watching Ghosts of Geonosis, Parts 1 and 2.
Rebels Season 3, Episodes 12 and 13.
In the meantime, you can find us on all the social medias, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Threads.
Patreon.
Oh, yeah, Patreon, where we're doing Visions Season 2, and then we're going to do a book report.
Yeah, Sam and I recently, or at least semi-recently,
it was 22 books ago,
read Master and Apprentice, which focuses on baby Kenobi and slightly younger Qui-Gon,
mm-hmm.
and also that other guy.
Yeah, Rael Avos?
Rael Avernus.
Yeah.
And Dooku.
We're taking it back.
Jinx, you owe me a darksaber.
Oh, man. Is that how Mandalorian Succession works?
That is 100% how it works.
All right. Well, send this episode to someone who jinxed you and now you owe them the keys to an entire kingdom.
Yeah, I guess it'll be me.
I guess so.
And make sure to drop us 5 stars on the podcast platform that you're listening on and write us a little love note, if you will. And tell us what you love about growing up Skywalker. It really helps us out.
Man, I'm really bummed about losing my empire just now.
Yeah, well, I am a magnanimous ruler. Perhaps I shall share some crumbs. Perhaps not. And we'll talk to you next Tuesday.
Bye, I guess.